You guys are only 2.5 back.
I know.
Hey,
it's
the
exciting.
Team is so mediocre. They have no underlying talent right now.
Oh, Chad.
We're throwing Gzelman,
Seth Lugo.
Lugo and Montero as our 3-4-5
starters.
Oh,
yeah, Montero. Yeah, that's right.
Oh, my God.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work, at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538, and back from Japan.
I'm back. Woo-hoo!
The stat man himself, Neil Payne, across the table. Hello, Neil.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Neil, are you sitting on the wrong side of the table because you were used to reading from right to left?
I'm also used to driving on the left side of the road. So it's all very different coming back here.
I appreciate that you've inverted me.
Did you eat sushi with your left hand?
No, but I ate with chopsticks, but that, not with the left hand.
Is that a thing, Kate, or because Neil's right-handed?
Everything was backwards?
Just inverting everything.
See?
I think they still eat, with the right hand with chopsticks.
Okay.
Yeah.
That other voice you hear is Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist, all the way from Bristol, Connecticut. Hello, Kate.
Hey, Chad.
Kate, you have been chatting about Colin Kaepernick nonstop
yep.
on your various media obligations. Let me tell you what we're not going to talk about this week on Hot Takedown. Colin Kaepernick.
Mm.
We didn't want to bring the numbers to that conversation.
Liberate yourself. You mean the number of black men killed and the
right.
number of slaves brought over into America in order to found the country? Yeah,
we
we're not going to bring that in.
Written stories on that, though.
So yeah, numbers. It was Hot Takedown listeners. This is a reprieve from the Sports Yak Fest in which many people who do not have a good handle on race relations and the history of racial oppression in the country try and tell you what to think about one man's protest against the national anthem.
Isn't that just always the case in all commentary?
Let's move on to what we're going to talk about today on the show. While we're still in the summer doldrums of sports in the U.S., the Brits are off and running. The English Premier League has started a new campaign, and Leicester City is already falling behind in its title defense. We're going to talk with ESPN's Mike Goodman about whether the EPL is returning to normal with historic rich teams on track to own the top of the table.
Just as we learn to pronounce the word Leicester, too, Chad.
We keep talking about this so that I can keep saying Leicester
yeah.
appropriately. And then to the U.S. Open, where Serena Williams is trying to avenge her loss in last year's finals. And Novak Djokovic is hoping to keep his hold on the men's side of the tournament. We have pried 538's Carl Bialik away from Queens for the day to come chat all things tennis with us. And he will be here in the studio to do so. And finally, what should a fan do when her favorite team leaves the city that she loves? 538's Blythe Terrell will stop by to explain her dilemma as a St. Louis Rams fan, or a no longer St. Louis Rams fan.
Because she's a free agent.
She's a free agent, and we're going to try and help her find a new team using numbers to do so. I sort of picture the segment as sort of one of those old noir mystery movies where, like, someone waltzes into a detective's office and they say, you know, Gumshoe, I really need your help. And the Gumshoe in this case is, of course, Neil Payne. So Neil will try and help Blythe find her new team.
And I'm sitting in a dark office right now with light streaming
yes,
through
exactly.
a
frosted window.
Yes.
This is the first of a two-part series. Today we're going to talk about what should go into such a search, and then we'll talk about the results of the search in a Hot Takedown coming soon.
From the moment she walked in asking about teams, I knew this was going to be trouble.
All right.
Oh, we're so corny.
Let's move on to soccer. English Premier League teams have all played three matches this season, and defending champions Leicester City has only won one of those matches. They are in ninth place. They are 1-1-1. Manchester United, Manchester City, and Chelsea, meanwhile, have won all three of their matches, putting them at the top of the EPL table. So, is it too early to say that we know what is going to happen in the EPL this year based on just those three matches? It's one of my favorite questions to ask in Hot Takedown. Is just take a total straw man argument. Like, so do we know?
Chad, that's one tenth of the season.
So we can't answer those questions ourselves because we are soccer dunces, and so instead, we welcome our deputy British sports correspondent, Mike Goodman, back to the show. Hello, Mike. Good to have you.
Good to be here. Does anybody ever answer yes when you ask, do we know what's going on definitively already?
You know, Mike, you'd think I would have learned by now to stop trying to pin people into a corner in which we try and find certainty in an uncertain world, but I haven't. But you're right. Within 538, basically, we never know anything until the event actually happens. All right, so Mike, this has been already a very interesting EPL season campaign. Is what we're seeing in these first three matches, was it at least expected that, that the old powers would come and reign supreme yet again?
So I think when you take the schedule into account, this isn't particularly surprising. City, United, Chelsea have all had fairly easy starts to the season. Leicester slightly less so, although they lost their opener to Hull City, which was fairly unexpected. But like more broadly, it's an interesting question as to what we expect to happen this year. There's sort of like a truism in soccer that like it's very easy. The easiest way to predict the season is to just look at last year and predict that it will happen again. You know, soccer kind of sits in that sweet spot. It's not really like baseball. We have a hard time breaking down like individual player performances, but there are enough games where it's not really like the NFL where one season isn't necessarily indicative of anything. So you can do a pretty good job usually just by saying, okay, let's look at last year and maybe tweak some things minorly, but not expect major changes. But last year was really, really weird, right? You know, Leicester winning, Chelsea imploding, the whole thing. It's like, so what are we supposed to believe now for this season? Do we believe in last year, or is last year an anomaly and we sort of expect Chelsea to bounce back and Leicester to maybe struggle some more?
Mike, that's why you're here, is to tell us what to believe.
What's interesting about Leicester to me is that, like, in the NFL, for example, if you win or if you have a very strong season, then your schedule is more difficult. I know that doesn't play out in other leagues or the Premier League, but you do have the fact that because Leicester was so productive last year, now they have Champions League matches that they have to play, which is a kind of added burden because they're so good. When you're looking specifically at them, do you expect that to actually impact them?
Right. So the Premier League schedule itself is really interesting because it's perfectly balanced, right? 20 teams, they each play everybody else home and away. But the top teams have this burden of extra games. And Leicester in particular, for a team that you think probably performed significantly better last year than their underlying numbers might indicate, and they had a relatively small squad that stayed very healthy, yeah, it's going to be a very big challenge for them this year when you factor in the added, you know, burden of midweek games, plus you sort of expect some regression to the mean anyway in their performance. Plus they lost one of their best handful of players in N'Golo Kanté, who went to Chelsea.
Real quick, Mike, when you say small squad, you mean there just aren't as many players that are good, or like they actually have fewer players on the payroll?
A little bit of both. It's soccer doesn't have a defined roster size in the same way that, say, the NFL does. So different teams go different depth before you get to what you would consider youth products or sort of more emergency type players who wouldn't be necessarily in the regular rotation.
Now, I know we haven't even let Neil speak yet, but I'm jumping back in.
I'm still waiting. That's the plan, Kate.
Yeah, box him out. Box him out.
You learned while I was in Japan.
Like, you say regression to the mean, and it's like that's almost become like white noise in my mind. But when you're talking about Leicester City, you say regression to the mean. There's two ways to look at that. Either like they're actually weren't as good as they were last year, or they're actually not that good, or other teams are going to get better or focus on them a different way. And perhaps that's a game of semantics we're playing, but do you really think there's still a regression to the mean for Leicester, or is it more other teams changing something?
Yeah, I think that's a good distinction to draw. There is, I would say, something of this very pure idea that Leicester's numbers were seventh or sixth best last year, and they performed significantly better than those numbers. So you would, everything else being equal, still expect them to perform somewhat worse this year. On top of that, there is a very real possibility that as they get focused on, plus the added burden of Champions League, plus having lost some talent, that their underlying numbers, you might predict them to, you know, decrease even further and be a still, you know, like greater challenge that they have to then deal with this year.
So, Mike, does that mean that the other teams kind of spent more? I know in the past, and we've even talked about this, where, you know, spending has been kind of a strong predictor of how a team would perform in the EPL. Did Leicester last year put a scare into these other kind of big name, big budget teams, and did they go splurging over the offseason?
There was a lot of spending. I'm not necessarily sure if it was driven specifically by Leicester or a giant new TV contract, but and not only on players, right? So Chelsea brought in Antonio Conte to manage them. He just managed Italy at the Euros, and before that, he was very successful, winning I think 3 championships in a row in Italy with Juventus. Manchester City brought in Pep Guardiola to manage them. He's probably the most successful current modern day manager. And Manchester United, of course, you know, brought in Jose Mourinho after last year Jose Mourinho sort of tanked out with Chelsea. So there's it's not just players, right? There's the managerial additions to the Premier League are really significant.
And is that kind of a new trend of sort of, instead of spending as much on players, spending on the manager? It makes me think of like college football teams who sort of are in this war for coaches because they're kind of the big names in the sport. But at college football, you can't pay the players. The coaches are what attracts the talent. In the EPL, perhaps more than any other sport on the planet, you can sort of pay the players a huge amount of money to convince them to come play for you.
Right. I think what we're seeing is both. I think what we're seeing is, because there's now so much more money floating around the Premier League, you're looking at teams spending not only on players, but also trying to add to, you know, the surrounding development.
Mike, do coaches matter in soccer? Because I think we talk.
Some do.
So in what sense? In the sense that, like, they attract the players, as Neil was maybe getting at, or in the sense that they train the players better? Is the tactics?
Yeah, there are certainly a limited number of managers who are able to elevate the talent levels of their squad beyond what you'd usually see. There are other managers who are incredibly unique talent-wise, or tactics-wise. So if you match them with the right kind of talent, you can sort of perhaps, you know, capture some sort of alchemy. And get a season or two or three of extra performance. You might look at Leicester last year with Claudio Ranieri and suggest that's part of what happened. So Pep Guardiola at Manchester City is incredibly unique, has been incredibly successful, has also managed at teams that had tremendously more talent than all but a couple of the teams around him. So there are questions as to exactly what it will look like when he doesn't have a huge talent gap between him and everybody else, but sort of the success coming in is significant.
And Mike, in the EPL, the manager is kind of what we would think of as both the coach over here in American sports and the GM, right? So how much of it is, for these guys that are kind of the highest paid and most talented managers, is it acquiring talent? And I guess this goes back to what Chad said. Is it finding the right talent for your system, or just being able to go out and make the best decisions to get the best roster and then kind of doing a conventional coaching job off of that?
Yeah, slowly but surely, soccer in general and the Premier League specifically are moving a little bit away from that sort of manager as king of the entire mm-hmm. kingdom of his soccer club.
The great model. Man theory of soccer.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you have to keep in mind, right, that soccer is a little bit behind American sports when it comes into becoming big business. So a lot of these clubs, you know, even 10 years ago, were closer to mom and pop stores than they would be to, say, Microsoft. And so as the money is pouring in, and as these what were smaller sort of companies are becoming, you know, legitimately huge billion-dollar industries, you are sort of seeing that the separation of talents slowly, you know, get teased out, where, you know, at Manchester City, there's clearly an infrastructure in place that works above Pep Guardiola.
So, Mike, one last thing before I antagonize you and force you to give us a prediction, even though I know you don't want to give one. We talk about how in baseball, about a third of the way through the season is maybe when you start to actually glean some information about which teams are good and which teams are bad. Do you have any sense, without actually having run the numbers yourself, of how far into a season, an EPL season, it takes before we know when to start trusting the tables?
Yeah, sure. We can. Well, two questions. One is, when can we get information? And if we use stuff like shot differentials and expected goals, somewhere around the 5-game mark, we can start to say with
that's early.
A
five
little
games.
Bit of confidence
wow.
who's good and who's not. that's not necessarily going to be reflected in the table until you're getting, you know, significantly further into the season, you know, towards the halfway mark, perhaps.
Interesting.
But those underlying metrics through five games are kind of really good or solid predictors, at least, of how the teams will eventually finish in the table?
They are pretty good predictors of what the underlying talent of a team
is.
Ah,
I see.
Right, because isn't part of the problem that there's so little scoring in soccer that there's a lot of variance within it, which we talk about a lot as well.
Exactly.
Okay. Right. All right, so Mike, who you got?
My pick is Manchester City to win the Premier League, followed by Chelsea, Manchester United, and Arsenal making up the top four. So it's sort of the tradition. You know, I'm sort of all in on a return to the traditional powers of the Premier League reasserting their dominance.
Hot takedown listeners, you heard it here first. The status quo returns to English Premier League soccer. Also, Mike, if people are interested in hearing you talk more about soccer, you've got a podcast, Double Pivot, that people can subscribe to.
Yeah. Double Pivot podcast. It's me and Michael Kelly, who I think has also been on Five, you know, Hot Takedown in the past. And we do it weekly. It usually comes out early in the week, Monday or Tuesday. And we talk about all things mostly European soccer.
Excellent. Listeners, check that out. Mike, as always, a pleasure to have you. Let's see if you get a new promotion by the time you appear next, as you've already moved up the ranks to Deputy British Soccer Correspondent. Mike, thanks as always for coming on.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Before we keep going with Hot Takedown and talk about tennis, we're going to take a moment out for a word from our sponsor. This week, Hot Takedown is sponsored by Stamps.com. These days, you can get practically everything that you want on demand, like this podcast, for example. You listen to it whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. So why are you still making time-consuming trips to the post office when you can get postage on demand, just like this podcast? And you can get that postage with Stamps.com. Anything that you can do at the post office, you can now do right from your desk with Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes, so you can get postage whenever you need it, 24/7. Plus, you'll even get special postage discounts with Stamps.com that you cannot find at the post office. So right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use the promo code ESPN to get this special offer, a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a digital scale. Again, go to Stamps.com. Don't wait. Before you do anything else when you get to that website, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in ESPN. That's Stamps.com, and be sure to enter the promo code ESPN. Okay, now on to tennis. Kate Fagan had to leave us, but she will be back for Significant Digit. And so to replace her, we have Carl Bialik. Hello, Carl.
Hi, Chad.
Carl, of course, is our senior global tennis correspondent, and he has spent every waking moment he can out in Queens for the U.S. Open. And Carl, this year we have a model at 538, which you have been combining with your on-the-ground appraisal of what's happening at the U.S. Open. And so given the data, given your own eyes, the eye tests, as we like to call it, who is going to win the U.S. Open?
According to our forecast, as
nice
of this
edge,
moment,
yes.
Very 538.
Before Serena Williams plays her first match, we are giving her a 55% chance of winning, which is quite a percentage. It was the same before the tournament, even though there are 127 other players in the field. We were giving her a greater chance than everyone else combined. And similarly, on the men's side, we were giving Novak Djokovic a 57% chance at the start of the tournament, and he's up to 59% now, and he's won one of the seven matches he would need to win the title.
Now, is that unusual, Carl? Or I get the sense that in tennis, the favorite kind of does steamroll through more often than not.
I'm going to give you my normal, it's complicated, and here are three reasons why answer. It's complicated, Neil.
And here are three reasons why.
So first of all, just compared to other forecasts, you're right. This is more confident. So we predict, for instance, March Madness, and for the teams that don't have to play the play-in games, who don't really have a chance anyway, those play-in teams, the favorites rarely have more than a 20-25% chance of winning going in.
What did we have Kentucky at that one year when they were undefeated?
I think even then,
like
we had them
39
under 40.
Or something?
Yeah, right, yeah. Under 40. And one of the things you've talked about in this program is it's because you have to win six games. And in this case, you have to win seven matches. So you think that's one more potential for a loss. I think we've also talked on the show, though, about how kind of overdetermined tennis is. You've got 100 or more points in a match, and You don't have the variables of other players or injuries or fouling out. There's much less role of officiating because there's a challenge system. And the draw really protects the top players. The draw protects top teams and team sports as well. But we also have here a case where we have two players who are about as dominant as we've had two players, plus some of their top rivals aren't playing. Federer's out and injured. Sharapova's out on a drug ban. Azarenka is pregnant and not going to play until after she has her kid. And we also have just sort of historically, if we were doing a really simple model, in recent last few years, Williams and Djokovic have won more than half of slams. So very, you know, by the seat of your pants, back of the envelope, whatever you want to call it, forecast would give them a greater than 50% chance.
So it's possible that kind of all of that confluence of factors that you mentioned just then might make this be sort of the best chance that favorites have kind of had in a long time, or perhaps one of the best chances they've ever had of winning a particular tournament, or just winning slams, generically speaking, in a year?
Well, I would love to do the exercise where now that we have these ELO ratings historically and we have historic draws, we could go back and answer that question. This is the first time we're officially forecasting it, so it's a little difficult to say. But let's say in the men's game in the late 90s when it was a bit of a mess, especially at a time when Agassi was injured or Sampras was off his game, my guess is you'd see a percentage way lower, maybe 10% or so. And you can kind of see it, especially on the women's side, in how the pack looks behind Serena Williams. On the men's side, there's a very clear number two in Andy Murray. But on the women's side, it's really closely packed in terms of percentages and in terms of ELO rating, which, as regular listeners of the show know, is how we're rating these players like we do so many other sports teams and players. And so if Serena Williams, let's say, were injured, and in fact she is injured, so if she loses because of the injury, which let's hope she doesn't for the sake of our forecast, then I think we would still see pretty low percentages for the other top women because they are so closely matched.
We should know the forecast does not take into account injury. Talk about Anthony Kerber a little bit, who is the second most likely to win according to 538's forecast. She's played Williams tight this year, in fact, beat her, was it in Wimbledon?
At
the Australian Open. And so, you know, is this the case where she's at 9% in the 538 forecast, but maybe that's underselling it given her dominance over Williams. Not dominance over Williams, her success
relative against, to other
yeah,
players.
Yeah. Her success against Williams relative to other players.
Yeah, so two things that the model doesn't directly take into account are injury, and Williams just lost early in Rio where Kerber went on to get the silver. And it doesn't directly take into account head-to-head, although if you beat another player, you benefit in
but
ELO.
Theoretically, but in tennis especially, there could be a matchup of styles in which one player, for whatever reason, has a style that is almost is better than the other, one matchup against the other.
Yeah, and in the Australian Open final, Serena Williams kept coming to net and Kerber kept passing her, and that was a big part of the upset. And in the Wimbledon final, a surface where Serena Williams is more comfortable on the grass at Wimbledon, Kerber still gave her a hard time, and Serena Williams played extremely well, but it was still two close sets. So I think the model maybe slightly undervalues Kerber. One of the things it doesn't take into account is if a player just skips a tournament, their ELO is just static. So Serena Williams didn't play Cincinnati. Kerber made the final.
Is that the tournament that preceded
the
US
Open? There's a week in just before the US Open when some players play, but the last major tournament before the US Open that almost everyone plays is Cincinnati. It's a tune-up. It's similar conditions. Williams and Djokovic actually skipped that tournament. And I think knowing that Kerber made the final, like the ELO ratings would barely be different because she ended up losing in the final, whereas Williams' ELO ratings stayed the same because she skipped it. But looking at it from the perspective outside ELO, that makes Kerber look like a stronger shot. And in fact, I have the privilege and terror of picking in the ESPN experts' picks before every Grand Slam. And even though I knew our model would say Djokovic and Serena Williams were the overwhelming favorites, I wanted to zig a little where everyone else zags, and I chose Murray and Kerber in that pool. So sorry to our ELO model.
So let's talk about the men a bit now. Djokovic is on top at 59% and Murray at 17%. As you mentioned, I think the New York Times or someone wrote a piece this week about whether the end of the Big Four had finally come. Djokovic has been a member of the Big Four and he's at 59% to win, and no one seems to really think that no one seems to be earnestly picking anyone else to win, maybe besides Murray.
And who is also part of the Big Four.
Right. And so it just seemed odd to me that like there was this conversation around it finally ending just because Federer was gone, who's maybe the forefather of the Big Four. And,
forefather, very appropriate word here.
And Nadal still sort of struggling through injury, it seems, year to year. And so is there just this rush to sort of like put a punctuation on an epic of tennis when actually we're still in the middle of the epic?
I think we see in every sport that there's such a rush to call an end to things and be the one to say you called it. I'd love to look up the track record of the people who are calling it now, because while maybe people didn't use those words, the end of the Big Four, there was back in 2008, we're talking 8 years ago, when Federer was struggling in the summer, there was a call of maybe this is the beginning of the end for him. 2009, Rafa gets injured, loses at the French Open. Maybe this is the end for Rafa. Djokovic and Murray, we haven't quite had the ends called for them. They're younger and have had fewer injuries, but Murray did have some injuries and setbacks in 2013 and 2014. Here he is. I think it's also a little semantic. So the end of the Big Four might mean the end of these are always going to be the top four guys in the semis. And that was always going to be an unstable situation to always have the same four guys. There was a period when they were all kind of near their peaks. I think in 2011, they pretty much made the semis of all four slams. And that was really never going to last and never had happened before. But if the question is more, will one of them win a title? Will one of them pick up the slack when the others don't? Our model says there's a 3 in 4 chance that one of them will. Actually, a bigger one. With Nadal, it's more like 4 in 5. So even without Federer, and with Federer now 35 years old, we still think that 3 of the 128 players have about an 80% chance, and these are 3 of the 4 players who have dominated the sport for about 10 years.
But the one interloper, just to kind of bring back perhaps my affinity for Japan since I was there the past 2 weeks. Yes, Kei Nishikori is ahead of Rafa Nadal, at least right now in our model, with a 7% chance, the best chance of any non-Big Four member. Is that kind of just sort of the model has to spit out someone as being, you know, kind of one of the people at the margins of defeating when you have Djokovic and Murray combining for, you know, almost 80% chance of winning? Or do you think he has a legitimate chance?
7% is a legitimate chance. I mean, it sounds about right.
Is it?
Yeah. You know, I think that one of the things we've seen this year that has made it feel like less of the Big Four, even though the Big Four is still winning most of the titles, is that guys like Nishikori are making late rounds of tournaments. They're just basically not winning them.
And that is factored into ELO, because when you win any given match to advance deep into a tournament, you pick up points that reflect
later.
Yeah,
every match you win or lose is reflected. And Nishikori just won bronze in Rio. He beat Nadal in the bronze medal match. He's had a lot of big wins. He beat Djokovic here in a semifinal 2 years ago. And he's in the opposite side of the draw from Djokovic and Nadal. One of the reasons...
That's probably one of the...
Yeah, so Nadal would have to face Djokovic to get to the final. Nishikori would more likely have to face Murray.
Yeah, so Nishikori, for example, has one fewer point of ELO than Nadal, but because of that seeding is why he's higher up. Okay, Carl, before we let you go, loyal Hot Takedown listeners will have noticed that your voice has appeared in their feed beyond just this podcast this week, and will continue to do so for the next couple weeks, and that's because you have your very own tennis podcast called Baseline. So what have people been missing out if they haven't been listening when they see it in their feed?
Yesterday, we rolled out the first episode, and it was a preview of the tournament, talking a little more about the forecast and about just how dominant of a storyline Serena Williams is, going for the record 23rd open-era major title. And we had on great guests, Caitlin Thompson and Courtney Nguyen, who are both involved with a new tennis quarterly called Racket. They both have their own wonderful tennis podcasts. And we have some great guests lined up, too.
Excellent. So, yeah, so Hot Takedown listeners, keep an eye out for that. Carl is ready to talk to you more, you know, and just be receptive to him. Welcome him into your routine, into your dog walks, into your commutes home. He's
and
a delightful voice.
Washing dishes, I hear.
Also
is a good
fine,
time.
Yes. All right. Carl Bialik, 538th Senior Global Tennis Correspondent. Thanks, Carl.
Thanks, Chad.
Before we keep going with the show, let's check in for a word from our second sponsor this week. Our second sponsor is DraftKings.com. If you're listening to this podcast, and you are listening to this podcast, you know a thing or two about sports, and you probably know a thing or two about football. Now you can put that knowledge to the test and play for your shot at the $1 million top prize at DraftKings.com. That $1 million is just part of the $5 million in total prizes they are doling out in their week one contest. DraftKings.com is the destination for one-week fantasy football. One-week fantasy means that you do not need to commit to a season's worth of fantasy. You get in, you get out, you play whenever you want with the players that you want. You just pick your contest, draft your players, and follow your team live as the action happens. You can play against friends and family in a private group or against strangers at large in public groups. So hurry to DraftKings.com now to choose your players, and you can seriously cash in week one. Use code TAKEDOWN while you're there and play for free with your first deposit. That's code TAKEDOWN at DraftKings.com to play for your share of the $5 million in total prizes in DraftKings.com's week one contest. Eligibility restrictions may apply. See the website, DraftKings.com, for details. All right, now onto the search for a new football team. 538's Blythe Terrell joined us. Hello, Blythe.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So, Blythe, by day, you are a senior editor at 538.
Sometimes by night, too.
Yeah, what is she by night?
Yeah, that's true.
Quite a setup.
But on weekend days, indeed Sundays, you were once a St. Louis Rams fan.
I was.
And the St. Louis Rams are no longer.
They are gone, RIP.
They have decamped for Los Angeles. And so you are, as Kate said, a free agent.
I am.
And we should say they decamped in kind of the ugliest way possible, probably, or one of the ugliest ways.
Yeah, it was kind of a burning bridges on the way out kind of a departure. Owner Stan Kroenke is receiving no love whatsoever from the city of St. Louis. Not that that was untrue before, but it's much truer now. He said some things that people were pretty upset by and offended by about the city, and people took them quite personally. There's all kinds of great conspiracy theories, et cetera.
And so, Blythe, just give us a quick history with the team. One of your history with the team, rather.
Right, sure. So, so my family moved to St. Louis in about 1988, which is after the St. Louis Football Cardinals had already departed. And the Rams arrived in 95. And so my mom right away was like, all right, this is great. She's a huge football fan. And she was like, okay, I'm doing it. Like, I'm getting the personal seat licenses. I'm getting the tickets. She ended up having to get more expensive tickets than she actually wanted. So we ended up with, like, eighth row end zone seats and sat there for the next 20 years, essentially.
Including the greatest show on turf,
greatest
right?
show on turf. I mean, I remember being extremely bummed out when Trent Green got hurt. And watching Kurt Warner come from...
Who's this bum, Kurt Warner?
Stacking groceries on shelves in northern Iowa, you know. And there he was with Marshall Faulk and with Isaac Bruce and all these great guys. And it was just like a really incredible experience. And we watched them win the Super Bowl and went to the, you know, the playoff games that we could. And it was just, it was really incredible. So they had some early success, which I'm sure helped in terms of like developing me as a fan. But, you know, my mom is very much a person who goes to the games and gets there pretty much on time, doesn't leave no matter what. I mean, we've seen a lot of garbage Rams teams over the years, and it's like we were there and we were cheering, and it just did not matter how pathetic they were. If they win two games, you know, we would be there. So we were pretty upset as a family, I think, to see them go. And it really was also like we had some people who sat in front of us for all those years, and like they watched us grow up. I mean, I was 12 when the Rams got there. My younger siblings were there, so even more adorable, cheering for their team with their mom. I mean, it was just like, it was our family's team. It was what we gathered to do on Sundays.
So, Blythe, you now live in New York. You mm-hmm. used to live in Boston. You have lived in St. Louis for a while now.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so you, especially without a team to root you to in St. Louis, to root you to a team, you are, you're a free agent. You're drifting. Mm-hmm. We all have some ideas about what you could maybe factor into mm-hmm. your search, and I know that you've contracted Neil Services to help look for this new team, but I'm wondering what you yourself are prizing as you go about trying to find a team.
Yeah, like if this is a real estate transaction, you're like, look, I need a balcony mm-hmm. with, you know, I can't have a tub, I have to have a stand-up shower. Like, we need to know what
we
are
your property brothers.
Yeah. Oh, what are your essentials excellent. Here in your fandom that Neil needs to prioritize?
Right, so...
winning isn't one of them.
Yeah, I'm willing to accept a team that has a lot of heart and fails frequently. That is totally fine. I think, you know, I want a team that doesn't have garbage ownership. That would be good. I don't want somebody, you know, who's just going to – a team that's just going to be uprooted and shipped off someplace. I don't – that might be a little bit hard.
So a commitment to the city?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, a commitment to a city or just – maybe a commitment to the city is a good way to put it. I don't know if you can quantify that or not. But that is something that in my ideal
You've been burned once.
Exactly.
You want to make sure that this next investment doesn't end. I mean, then it's like a fool you twice situation.
Right, right. So, you know, I had to have nobody to blame but myself, and I don't want to end up in that situation. I want to be able to buy some gear and keep it for a few years, you know. So that's important. I also, you know, one thing that matters to me is I'd love to cheer for a team that with players that, you know, don't have a ton of history of sexual assaults or domestic violence. That would be good. Obviously that's not necessarily the most important thing, but it is it would be nice to have a team where you had some people you could get behind both as players and as people.
So Neil, as you're thinking through this, it's got to be difficult to try and quantify some of that, or for example, the chances that the team will at least make the playoffs is maybe something that's maybe a little more quantifiable. So I'm wondering how you are approaching this problem where it's difficult to, especially without a database of, you know, players who've, let's say, committed serious violent acts. You know, that would be difficult, but maybe you can start to think about a coach's approach to the locker room or something. I don't know.
Right. So on the point of violence against women and kind of just having a roster that doesn't get arrested a lot for whatever reason, there we do have data on that. Our own Allison McCann actually did a story, I think our first year here at ESPN. She kind of painstakingly recorded all of the domestic violence and, you know, kind of assault arrests that players had and classified them. So I'm hoping to kind of tap into that resource and use that to quantify that particular factor. So that one might be one of the easier ones in the sense of, you know, trying to put a number on things. But yeah, in some cases, you're going to have to use sort of proxy metrics instead of, you know, kind of trying to get close to measuring the kind of abstract idea of what we would ideally measure. And in some cases, you know, ESPN, the magazine every year, has done this kind of survey of fans and experts and stuff that they call the ultimate standings, that they rank every team across a variety of factors, including like affordability of going to a game, you know, coaching, leadership, fan relations with, you know, between the team and the fan base in terms
Sounds
of like
promising.
Reaching out to them and
hey,
kind of, yeah, using technology to kind of interact with the fans. Ownership, that they have a category that describes basically honesty and loyalty to core players in the community, which
Boom.
Sounds pretty pertinent to what we're talking about here. The likability of the players to the extent that you can kind of put a number on that. The stadium experience, the bang for the buck as a fan. And then we even talked about Blythe doing something that I cooked up called the bandwagon index, because you didn't want to be a bandwagon fan.
Right.
And so I kind of looked at sort of using the age of the team and its ELO rating, which is our kind of power rating for football teams in the most recent season. And I even tested like things like, you know, how much did you invest in the draft in recent years? And that turned out not to be significant, but basically kind of projecting the team's wins over the next five seasons. And the bandwagon index is the teams that have the biggest difference between that and their wins over the preceding 5 years. So you don't want to maybe join up with a team like the Patriots, although you could, you know, depending on how these things shake out. And the important thing is, you know, after I've kind of put all of these numbers in the rankings and I've tapped into Paul Lucas's UniWatch uniform rankings, I'm adding variables for like the proximity to us here in New York, but then also the proximity to St. Louis,
right, and go with
your
my mom.
Hometown and your mom. And things like tradition, you know, winning tradition for teams, all of those things. I'm going to ask you to take a survey and kind of, it's a paired matching algorithm where
but I have input.
where you basically, it gives you two options and it asks you which of these is more important to you as a fan when determining which team to root for. And it does that a bunch of times and it infers a ranking of what are the most and least important factors of the mm-hmm. things that I have. And I'm going to use those as weights to weight each team in each category, and the result will kind of spit out a master index weighted by what you think is most important and how the teams kind of rank in each category.
Well, okay. Can I add, Neil, I don't know how we're going to quantify this, but I have to add in. Hearing Blythe talk about her Rams fandom, it seemed like it was wholly evolved from the familial ties and the kind of like communication lifeline that sports feeds our families and our friends and those interactions. Correct me if I'm wrong there, Blythe.
No, I think that's fair.
So is there any way to then ascribe value to each NFL team? And I know this is going to be unique to one person as opposed to just like every Rams fan, but to which teams would provide some semblance of that for Blythe going forward? Because like obviously now she lives in New York, so there's got to be a higher value given to like the Giants or the Jets, because now she's going to have a communication line open to probably a lot of her friends in the city. Or if her, wherever her family came from before St. Louis, maybe there's roots there where aunts and uncles root for that team. Like, how do we incorporate her actual initial decision to love the Rams? Like, we have to ground that in this decision as well. But I don't want to speak for you.
Unfortunately, I think my grandparents' side, they're Buccaneers fans, which would be sort of a bummer.
Oh, but that's interesting.
That is a really interesting question, Kate, because you're totally right on about how my fandom developed. So, Neil, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts.
Well, I can try to get at some of that with the proximity metrics, like we mentioned, you know, proximity to New York and to St. Louis, and then kind of through this process of asking you through these questions, which are most important, kind of figuring out how much weight to put relative on each one. And then also, you know, if we're thinking about like the factors that maybe we had talked about this briefly, and I don't have something for this yet, but maybe we could cook up something of maybe you might judge as one of your factors like sticking it to the Rams. Maybe that like kind of the,
gonna take
the degree
out
of rivalry with the Rams, and you know, certainly that would weight it toward NFC West teams. You also mentioned I was going to put in a uniform factor. You said anything to push the Seahawks down. So maybe that might not, there's something at cross purposes there. But, you know, those are kind of the things that we can do. I don't know if we can kind of spark, what creates that spark and that love for a team you kind of, you know, create it organically. I don't know. Some of this is trying to kind of almost algorithmize what does create that spark.
Algorithmize love. Blythe, one of the other things that you said was that being at the game was really a big part of your attachment to them. Now,
Chad's just trying to get me to cheer for the Jets.
It's more expensive to go to a Giants game, so you should be a Jets fan.
We do have bang for the buck and fair relations and stadium experience.
It does seem, it doesn't seem to me that you probably are going to get your own personalized seat license for whatever the new team is, maybe even if it's the Jets or the Giants. But I do wonder whether a pilgrimage to the stadium is going to be a part of your adoption process, and whether that should be factored in, because some of these games are impossible to get a ticket to at anything less than $300, let's say, whereas others, for a bad team, for example, you know, there are some teams that can't have enough tickets sold to the point where they got blackouts, like in Jacksonville. So I'm wondering if...
Yeah, but Blythe, if you become a Giants fan, you're going to have friends who have season tickets, like the one person you're talking to right now, and they will gladly, in order to recruit a Giants fan, give you two tickets for the in-game experience if you promise to like come aboard.
Well, that's very interesting. We didn't take into account bribery.
Yeah,
right.
I feel like I'm the only one being unbiased here in terms of...
Surprise.
Yeah.
Yeah, Neil. Well, what's also interesting, though, about the whole strategy, I mean, obviously there's a lot of different points people are raising that are really interesting. But because Neil is going to be putting these factors head-to-head and I'm going to be just sort of clicking, you know, what the first thing that comes to my mind, I could end up with weights that are totally different from what I thought I cared about, which I think is also going to be really interesting to see, too. You know, like, what if it turns out that I have to be a Patriots fan, which, you know, we've also talked about would be a shame. But, you know,
the
it's like...
The data knows you better than you know yourself.
Exactly. Like, is that what's going to happen?
One question on this is, how binding do you want this to be when the algorithm spits out its final answer? Is that kind of, are you beholden to rooting for that team, or do you have kind of the... I can give you a listed ranking from 1 through 32, and so maybe if you don't like number 1, you'll just go down the list until you find one that you can feel personally comfortable with rooting for.
Oh, that's interesting. It doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, or shouldn't she have like a captivito number or something, right?
Right.
You only get, it's like a jury selection or something. You only get so many
exemptions or whatever.
Well, I think I was thinking about this actually, like what I might do. And I was thinking I would commit to a season.
Okay.
And I would say, okay, you know, that the team that comes out of this is the team that I'm cheering for this season. the first team, no matter who it is.
A season with the algorithm.
I like it. Okay, right. So in a week or two, probably we're
next
gonna
week.
Have you. We're next week. We're gonna have you back on with the results of this search. Mm-hmm. Kate will have hacked into Neil's computer by then to weight things towards the Giants, and you'll be. Rewarded.
I think Josh Brown is probably gonna hurt me on the. If it's
point.
Programmed into the algorithm on rests, but.
All right. Well,
depends on when we update the data. To be honest,
they do have good uniforms. I'll give them that.
See.
Listeners, if you want to hear more from Blythe, she just started a science podcast in the What's the Point feed, the 538 What's the Point feed. It's called Sparks. The last time they chatted, it's sort of a book podcast that you don't actually have to read the book in order to listen to. Blythe, do you want to just say a minute more about that?
Yeah, well, what we do is we take a book about science and we read it as a group, me and the science writers, and then we sort of pull back from it and talk about the big science ideas that it contains. So we try to sort of put it in context in terms of other conversations that are happening in the science world. So if you miss the book, it's fine. You can go back and read it later. You can read it not at all. You can decide it sounds terrible. But yeah, so we've done our first one and we'll have another one later this month.
Yeah, first episode is great. It's sort of on the nature of activism, science, and what happens when they cross, mm-hmm. and what does evidence mean when it's being framed within both a scientific empirical lens and also an activist lens. So take a look for that in the What's the Point feed. All right,
thanks.
Blythe Terrell, talk to you next week.
Okay, thanks everybody. It was fun.
And now, as always, to our significant digit when we hear about a telling number from the world of sports. Neil Payne, this week, my understanding is you have a significant digit for us.
Okay. Well, so my significant digit actually comes from a story that was written by our football freelancer Chase Stewart that ran on the site on Monday, and it's 135. That is the number draft pick that the Dallas Cowboys used to take Dak Prescott in the 2016 NFL draft, and now Dak Prescott is their starting quarterback, and it's pretty crazy that to have a player of that low of a draft pick as a rookie starting for an NFL team in week one. In fact, there was only one other person that was drafted so low and also still started for a team in the first week, and that was a guy named Randy Hedberg. He started for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in 1977. He also finished his career with 0 touchdowns, 10 interceptions, a 28% completion percentage, 2.7 yards per attempt, a 0.0 passer rating. He was truly terrible, and the Cowboys, without Tony Romo, they're certainly hoping that Prescott will be better than Hedberg this season.
Now, this obviously, Neil, leads to the question of whether or not you, Neil Payne, believe that the NFL preseason, in which Dak Prescott has lit the world on fire, is any sort of indication of NFL regular season performance, and have you individually done some sort of analysis of the stats to prove to us that there is value in the NFL preseason? Please take it away.
Okay, so obviously the meaningfulness of preseason football is often ridiculed, and I think that's mostly correct. But one thing that I did a couple years ago was I looked at teams that had new quarterbacks, kind of a different quarterback than they had the previous year, and looked at the performance in the preseason, and then to see if that kind of caused a change in the team. So, you know, looking at the difference between their performance in the regular season with this new quarterback versus their performance the previous year with their old quarterback, and it turned out that it wasn't totally meaningless in that one particular case, that there was a weak but somewhat significant relationship between, if you have a guy who comes in as your new starter and lights the world on fire, like you said, Kate, in the preseason, that does bode well for your team performing better in the passing game that season than they did the previous season. And in the case of the Cowboys, you know, Dak Prescott, that probably bodes well for him just, you know, outperforming Randy Hedberg, for instance, like we mentioned before. And we should also say that the Cowboys last season also missed Romo for most of the year. He only started 4 games, and he was kind of his typical, you know, pretty decent self. But the rest of the quarterbacks, like has been the case throughout Romo's career, it feels like with the Cowboys, his backups have been horrible last year. It was a combination of Matt Cassel and Kellen Moore and Brandon Whedon, and they were all, you know, pretty bad for the most part, or at least below average. And so through that lens, maybe that gives Cowboys fans hope that even though he probably won't replicate what Romo is capable of doing when healthy, that he might be an upgrade over what they had last year, which was, you know, pretty bad, below average.
Thank you. I thought you were going to talk about how Mark Sanchez isn't starting for a National Football League team yet again.
Well, we ripped that
significant digit away from me. No, it's fine. We don't have to hear it.
We can talk about that, but that was the Broncos, right? That was the story.
I'm just saying you're depriving us of an opportunity to make fun of Mark Sanchez, which is fine. That's your prerogative, but it's an unfortunate choice.
We like the low-hanging fruit on this podcast.
All right, we'll do it for this week's show. Kate Fagan, thanks for calling in from Bristol.
Thanks, guys.
Neil Payne, thanks for chatting.
Thanks, Chad.
One more reminder to listen to Baseline while it's in your Hot Takedown feed. It's our podcast from the grounds of the U.S. Open, hosted by Carl Bialik. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast rookie starting QB is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcasting app and on iTunes, of course, as well. iTunes.com/538 will get you where you need to be. Be sure to review, rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin.
And Chad, just one more note.
Oh my! I was
breaking
moments
news.
Away from finishing this show.
Well, breaking news, as we were finishing the show, I saw a story that said that the Broncos were shopping Mark Sanchez to the Dallas Cowboys. A true confluence of sig digs.
You know who's available?
Who else is available? Tim Tebow.
The Rockies can pick him up and just lend him across town.
Right.
All right, may I finish now, Neil?
Yes.
I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.